I first met my friend Nick in middle school. At the time, we weren't really friends, but I did get to know him a little bit. Frankly, he scared me when I first met him. He was one of those kids who wore all black, gave himself piercings during class using safety pins, etc. He was bipolar and had a slew of other issues as well, including being on drugs at the time too. Fast forward a few years to high school. I didn't really have any friends and was kind of a loner. I also have a fall birthday, so I was one of the first kids in my class to turn 16 and get my license and start driving myself to school. Nick had grown out of the goth, druggy phase, got on medication for his psychological problems, and seemed like a fairly normal guy now. One day, he was talking to me and asked me if I could give him a ride home. I was happy to, since at the time I was pretty desperate for someone to hang out with. I ended up becoming very good friends with him and another guy he hung out with, and the three of us pretty much spent all of high school as a group. Looking back, they kind of took advantage of me as my family had more money than either of theirs, and I was more than happy to share. I drove them to lunch and paid for it part of the time, when they didn't have money. It was never anything major, just a few bucks here and there, and we really did have some good times. They were pretty good guys for most of the time, but I do feel like that was at least part of the reason they became my friends. Even if that was the case, it was worth it for me, because they were literally the only bright spot in an otherwise miserable high school experience. Nick could be an asshole sometimes, especially if you spent more than a day or so with him at a time. I took a week-long trip to the beach with his family, and ended up hanging out with his brother more than him, because he drove me insane. There was a particular incident at a go-kart track, where he literally was screaming at a 10-year-old kid and trying to pick a fight with the kid's father after the race because he had cut him off on the track. He then got pissed at me for not backing him up when I was too busy trying to crawl into a corner and pretended like I didn't know him because he was being so ridiculous. I was embarrassed, and friend or not, I was kinda hoping the guy would kick his ass because he deserved it. After high school, Nick stayed in our hometown and went to the local community college, while me and the other guy went to the state university a few hours away and were roommates. We would see Nick when we came home on the weekends. After that year, he joined us. Nick struggled and was in and out of school, never really trying that hard. At one point, his girlfriend from high school cheated on him and he took it pretty hard. They started adjusting his medication, and I don't think they ever really got it quite right, because he was never the same again. During this time, I introduced him to my girlfriend's sister. We actually had gone to school with her, but never really knew her until I started dating her sister. Anyway, they started dating, and at first, it was cool. We could go on double dates and stuff. I was a little worried though, because I knew he could be an asshole sometimes, and I was afraid of what might happen if their relationship went south. Her parents hated him, and I was always trying to defend him as best I could, without making them hate me too. I had gotten engaged to my girlfriend, so I felt like I was always in the middle between my future in-laws and one of my best friends. Eventually, they got engaged too, which her parents really hated. They rushed into getting married. I think they had been together for less than a year at the time. They moved in together while we were still in school. Things went south rather quickly. He started expecting her to support him, quit going to school, and said he was going to live on disability for the rest of his life because of his issues, and on top of that, they pretty much fought constantly. They had only been married for around 4 to 5 months when he started threatening... They had only been married for around 4 to 5 months when he started threatening to kill her. He even went as far as to detail the plans he had come up with to do it. Needless to say, she left and they got divorced after less than a year. This put me in the awkward spot of having to choose between my fiancé and her family, or one of my only friends. I tried to defend him as best as I could, saying things like, "He's not really like that. His medication is still messed up. He doesn't mean it. He won't really do that." But how can you truly stick up for someone who's threatening to murder his wife? I did the best I could. But ultimately, if I wanted to keep my fiancé, I had to lose my friend. Our other friend was supposed to have been my best man, but he refused after what happened with Nick. So I ended up losing both of my friends over the ordeal. Pretty much exactly what I have been afraid of. The last time I spoke to Nick, He had come into the store I was working at with some people I had never seen before. I said hey and waved, and he immediately flipped me off and walked out the door. So that was pretty much confirmation that our friendship was completely over. I'm really not sure how any of this was my fault, but apparently I was supposed to completely leave a 6-year relationship and break things off with my engagement because he was a psychopath who threatened to kill her sister and she left him. I really wish this was the end of the story, but it continues. Her sister found someone new who is an amazing guy and is now one of my closest friends, and I have far more in common with him than any of my old friends. He's been like a brother. I graduated, got married, moved homes, and started a family. My now wife's sister got remarried to a new guy, and they had a kid together who is now 3 years old. Everyone was happy and we pretty much forgot about Nick. Until the day he came back to town and started working at the local grocery store. My mother-in-law was the first to see him, and pretty much forbid her daughter from shopping there anymore. She was terrified that he would come after her or her kid if he saw them. They ended up moving to the other side of town shortly afterwards anyway, so not really a big deal. I wasn't as threatened by him, so I continued to shop there. I assume, since it had been 5 years, that he has moved on with his life too. I would see him working a register or something, but other than that, I really didn't go out of my way to avoid him. One day I saw him looking at me and sort of nodded. I didn't speak to him because of the way our last interaction had gone. I was met with the coldest stare I've ever seen. After that, anytime I was in the store, he would be there following me around. It was almost the way a store will have a worker shadow someone they think might be stealing. Whenever I looked up, he would be nearby. When I left the store, he would head outside to bring in carts or something, and watch me until I was in the car leaving. The last time I shopped there, I made the mistake of taking my newborn son. He started fussing, so of course I picked him up, and I tried to calm him down. At that point, Nick walked by and slammed into me, nearly making me drop the baby. He then walked off like nothing happened. I decided that day it would probably be best if I just started shopping at Walmart and realized that I'd forgotten to sit out the trash to be picked up. It was around 3 a.m. when I went outside to move the cans to the curb. As I walked out of my garage, a large van with blacked out windows suddenly came down the street and just stopped at the end of the driveway. I was nervous since it was 3 a.m. and it clearly was not a neighbor. So I took my time fiddling with the cans beside the house, waiting to see what they were going to do. Eventually, they slowly went down the street and stopped. I put the cans out as fast as I could and went back inside, making sure all the doors were locked. I went to sleep with my gun on the nightstand. It was also around this time my grandmother's house was broken into. Whoever did it knew where everything in her house was because they didn't rummage through anything. They went straight to where her jewelry was and took most of it. And then they went straight to the closet where my grandfather's guns were and took several of them as well. About a week later, they returned and cleaned out what they hadn't taken the first time. We have no proof, so the cops won't do anything. But we're fairly certain it was Nick. He had been to her house before, and I had shown him the guns when we were friends. Since whoever broke in knew exactly what they were looking for and exactly where to find it, that pretty much narrows down the list of suspects. I've seen the van driving around in front of the house late at night several more times since. It's becoming less frequent since I started shopping elsewhere, and thankfully, nothing else has happened. I keep my gun nearby at night now. I'm still hoping that this doesn't escalate again. About 4 years ago, I was a junior at a small college in LA County. Bordering my town was a large cavernous region known as Turnbull Canyon. It's the kind of place that has a healthy amount of creepy folklore surrounding it, with an area emphatically known as Hell's Gates, stories of cultic activity, gang killings, abandoned mental institutions, and the like. The kind of shit you hear about any place old enough to have a reputation. In reality, most of these stories were spurned from a tragedy that occurred years prior. A woman's body had been found at the base of the canyon, and from then on, the rest is history. Nevertheless, when a photographer friend asked me and another buddy to go out to the canyon in order to help him take some photos of the LA skyline, I had to oblige. The canyon is about a 30-minute drive from our campus, and we had been listening to the King of Limbs the entire drive, which proved to be the perfect ambience to get me feeling pretty anxious about our excursion. I should also note that I'm a pretty anxious guy in general, so traveling out to a remote area preceded by its reputation for scary occurrences admittedly had me thinking twice about the decision. At the top of the canyon, there is a small residential area, a few ritzy houses surrounded by trees and woods. In order to venture into the canyon itself, you have to follow a main trail with several smaller arteries that split off into other directions, but ultimately culminate after a couple of miles or so at the base of a steep hill, adorned with an old water tower overlooking the city. Anyhow, we parked our car at the top of the canyon road, got out the camera gear, and made our way out to the trailhead, around 1 a.m. at this point. After watching the trail for about 5 minutes, Dave, the photographer, decided it was time to set up his first shot, while Jeff, our other friend, and I kept watch. Eventually, he got the shot he needed, and we continued walking for another 5 minutes or so, before Dave decided to set up his next shot. At this point, the trailhead had disappeared behind us completely, and we were a little less than a quarter mile away from the water tower. While setting up the tripod, we noticed the faint glow of headlights off in the distance, which was strange because the trail wasn't meant for cars, nor was it big enough for them to pass through. If I recall, it was only about 5 feet wide, with shrubbery on both sides. This was clearly a bit of a red flag for us, as we were the only people out there. So we immediately packed up our things and ducked off into the brush, waiting for the car to pass on. Eventually, an old pickup truck idled to a stop about 50 yards from where we were hiding. The truck itself was old and rickety, sitting on a lifted chassis, the bed of which was missing entirely. Growing up in the country, I knew it was the type of truck typically owned by backwoods folk who lived in the boonies and preferred to be left to their own devices. We watched in agonizing anticipation as the truck just idled in place for several minutes before flooring it down one of the other trails, the roar of the engine echoing throughout the canyon. Clearly, we were spooked at this point, the three of us speculating as to our next step. Jeff and I were reluctant to continue, while Dave assured us that it was probably nothing, perhaps just a guy off-roading, as he put it. So with great reluctance, Jeff and I trudged on behind Dave toward the water tower to get his final shots. Nevertheless, I couldn't shake the feeling that something was off about the truck. I mean, I knew plenty of people in high school who would go off-roading for fun in the woods, but never on finicky canyon trails barely wide enough to hike on, let alone drive. It just didn't sit right with me. After walking without interference for about an hour, we finally made it out to the water tower, climbed up to the top, and took in the view of the city. Dave once again started setting up his equipment, while Jeff and I stood on both sides of the water tower, keeping watch just in case the truck came back. There was nothing at this point, nothing. At this point, it was around 3 a.m. Dave decides he's got all the shots he needs. So we pack up our equipment and commit to heading out before it gets too late, seeing as how all of us have classes in just a few hours. Just as we were preparing to descend the hill, the truck comes roaring out of the canyon below us, back onto the trail, at which point the driver attempts to climb the hill, revving his engine loudly. Scared shitless, the three of us slid off the side of the hill into the brush, clinging onto plants and rocks. As the truck finally made it atop the hill, slowly driving around the tower, we could see the glow of headlights each time it circled above us. After waiting for nearly 10 minutes, while also trying not to make any noise, the truck eventually descended the hill, stopping in the middle of the trail not more than 100 yards away. We watched as a scruffy man, mid-50s, stepped out of the idling truck and into the glow of its headlights, moseying around while looking at the ground. He then knelt down, looking at something in the dirt, surveying the area intently. As he did so, it became increasingly apparent that he was tracking something. Our footprints. This next part still chills me to the bone. As my friends and I huddled together watching in complete terror, another man wearing a long, dark parka emerged from the bush right where we had been hiking, joining the other man at his side. Apparently, he had been out there the entire time, while we were walking the trail, just watching us. Following behind at a safe distance, the two of them talked for a while. We couldn't hear a word. They continued scanning the area, looking at our footprints, but eventually got in the truck and drove down to one of the forks in the trail. We sat in silence for a long time, waiting nearly 2 hours to ensure the coast was clear, at which point we made like hell back to the car, down the canyon, and back to our campus, just in time for class. I was a bouncer at a bar years ago. It was a normal Friday night, completely packed. The usual customers were there, and they knew not to get too crazy. At around 11 o'clock, people usually started to get out, and sometimes I would have to break up a fight or two. Tonight was no different, and around midnight, a guy got too touchy and feely with a woman. She didn't like that, and I had to escort him out. The guys I kicked out were always good guys, but just had too much to drink. I would usually see them again, and they would apologize for their behavior. This Friday night, shortly before closing time, a man threw his drink at the bartender and cut his head open. I grabbed the guy and threw him outside. They would normally struggle for a second or two, and then realize that they had no chance of overpowering me. This guy was different. He struggled the whole time, and he was almost able to stack up to me. I could tell he had a violent temperament and was used to fighting. After his ass hits the sidewalk out front, he sits up and says something like he'll be back, or that I would see him later. I can't remember exactly. The bartender was alright, but he did need to go get a few stitches. It was closing time anyway, so we just told everyone that we were wrapping up the place in 20 minutes, and we would appreciate them making their way out. I helped clean up as I always do, and when I was finished, my buddy who worked at the kitchen always left with me out the back door. We were walking down the alley behind the place when two of us noticed that there was somebody behind us. We just kept walking. I turned left down the street where my car was parked. My buddy crossed the street and continued down the alley. I kept turning around to see if the guy would follow me or him, but I didn't see him cross the street or turn the corner that I had. I got to my car and drove 4 miles to my house. I had the following day off, but the day after that I was scheduled to work again. Before I left for work that night, my good friend and the owner of the bar called me and gave me terrible news. My buddy who was walking with me the other night was attacked and stabbed to death in the alley. I couldn't believe it. I told the cops about the jerk in the bar that night, but they never found out who killed him. I don't work at that bar anymore, but I did for another 2 years after the incident. That guy never showed up there again. I feel very strongly that it was him who attacked and killed my buddy that night. This happened many years ago, probably about 20 years ago actually, when my single father moved myself and my two little sisters to a not terrible but not great suburb of Denver, Colorado. The divorce had shattered him and our home. My mother left him for another man, and the burden of raising 3 girls befell him. Skip forward a couple of months. I'm 10, my sisters are 8 and 6. We had grown fairly accustomed to the neighborhood and the close surrounding areas. My dad is working 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. in Denver, where all the best pay is, and the responsibility of my two little sisters became mine. I was the eldest after all. We hadn't quite melded with other kids in the area yet, but being the three of us, we didn't mind. We were capable of entertaining ourselves. We used to ride our bicycles everywhere, to all the surrounding neighborhoods, the hiking trails along the river that led everywhere, even along the train tracks, which we could find numerous amounts throughout the town. One set of tracks in particular, in fact, the closest set to our home, had a long ditch like a valley along both sides of it. I think in retrospect, it had been some type of flood barrier to prevent the river from flooding out the neighborhood across the street. Anyway, on one side of the tracks, it was a sheer drop-off, with heavy bushes and undergrowth preventing the ground from being easily accessible, and on the other side there had been a path carved out. It appeared to be by vehicles, maybe servicing the train tracks in prior years, but it was extremely deep. They called it Dead Man's Ditch, I found out later on, but this information doesn't become relevant until later. So, as I said, we used to ride our bikes around town a lot, especially in the summertime, during the day while Dad was at work, and we could travel further than he allowed. We also had a game we played, similar to Punch Buggy, combined with a license plate game. If any of us saw a license plate with double or triple characters, consecutively, example, double B's or triple zeros, we would announce it, and then we would attempt to hit one another. It was barbaric, but we were siblings, so it's not outlandish. I don't want to share mine or my sister's names here, but on this particular day, we had been riding around for hours, and we were past the hottest part of the day. It was cooling down and was gearing up for sunset. We had made our way back toward home, and we were less than a 2-minute bike ride from our house. I had been hanging back a bit, so both of my little sisters were in front of me, the youngest in front, the middle coming up on her left, and myself about 6 feet behind. A few minutes prior, a silver sedan had driven past us, going the opposite way. The car's plate had double sixes, which I had called first. As we were heading up the street, I heard a vehicle accelerate impatiently behind me. This set off red flags, because where we were riding, we actually affected the oncoming lane. This vehicle was heading the same way we were. I turned to look, and automatically glanced first at the license plate, then at a silver sedan. Mr. Double Six was back. Now I could see him. He was Hispanic, in his mid-40s, wearing a blue and red flannel, with no shirt underneath. He didn't say a word. He just looked at me for a second, and then sped up, veering into our lane. I watched in horror as his open driver's side window lined up with my baby sister, and he reached out and grabbed her hand and the handle to her bicycle. He slowed down a bit, trying to pull my sister off her bike and into his open window. But something happened in his car, because all of a sudden he released my sister and put both hands back on the wheel. She took the chance and pushed like hell on her bike, racing towards Dead Man's Ditch. My other sister and I followed suit. After a moment of what I now know is tunnel vision, I heard the acceleration of the sedan again behind me. By this time, we were all hysterical, and I was trying desperately to see through tears. This guy wasn't giving up. Whatever his deal was, he didn't want to let it go. Dead Man's Ditch was approaching quickly. Thinking on my feet, I directed both sisters down the ditch, assuming Double Six wouldn't destroy his vehicle attempting to follow. My youngest sister cowered in fear at the top, whimpering about being afraid of falling. The middle sister did not need to be told twice. She flew down the hill like it was nothing. As I caught up to them, the car was right on my back tire. So I said, "Just go! This guy is going to kill us!" I remember hearing her take in a huge breath and letting her bike go down the hill. I held my breath until I was right behind her. All three of us made it down the hill, and the guy pulled his car right up to the opening of the path. He got out of his car, and he was naked, wearing only the aforementioned flannel shirt, and boasting a giant hard-on, which he proceeded to tug and wave in our general direction. I stood between my sisters and this creep, and after a few minutes of his exposure, I guess he decided that we weren't worth the destruction of his car. He got back in his car and drove away. My sisters and I were both hysterical, although my 10-year-old mind had switched to business mode, and the tears ceased to follow. My only concern now was getting my sisters home safely. We waited for about a half an hour, but the car never came back. We braved the emerging trail and hightailed it home. When we got home, we told Dad everything. He was outraged, understandably so, and took us in his car to drive around to try to find the man. But we didn't find him. But my dad called the police once we got back home, and we filed a report. Unfortunately, with only a description of a silver four-door car, with a license plate that began with 66, and an older Hispanic man, wasn't enough to track him down. They filled in Dead Man's Ditch a couple of months later, but not before it had saved our lives. I'm telling this story on behalf of my best friend Tom, who I've known since childhood. He served with the Army for several years in infantry with the 1st Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment. After he returned home from his combat tour in Afghanistan, he had more than a few stories to tell. I'm immensely sad to say that we lost Tom in a car accident recently. However, this is one story from his time in Afghanistan that I always felt was a good one to share. Tom agreed. He also visited Let's Not Meet occasionally, but never quite found the time to sit down and write about his experiences. There are many stories that will forever remain between me and him, but I know this is one that he's always wanted to share. With that in mind, I'll do my best to pass it along. I want it noted that the details are somewhat hazy, as it's been a long time since his last retelling. In 2013, Tom's unit was deployed to Afghanistan's Kandahar province. He was a private first class at the time, and had been in the army for a year by the beginning of the tour, with the last several months of that assigned to the 1st Ranger Battalion. He'd gone through immensely difficult training, up to and including jumping out of several airplanes to get to where he was now, and as such, was eager to finally do his job. He ultimately participated in 19 combat missions during his 4 months in country, all of them night raids aimed at high-valued targets, local Taliban cell commanders, and other persons of interest. You see, the Rangers and other special operation forces specialize in nighttime operations. They train at night and operate frequently under the cover of darkness. The Taliban lacked widespread night vision optics, whereas each individual Ranger was equipped with some of the finest NODs money could buy, and the accessories to complement them. With that advantage on top of their large numbers and superior training, it was hard for them not to feel like they owned the night whenever they went out. However, this wasn't always the case. One night, Tom's platoon was tapped for yet another HVT raid. After the typical briefing and preparation process, the 30 or so guys boarded the Canucks and proceeded to the targeted location, disembarking under the cover of darkness to secure the area. Tom was a member of a two-man machine gun team. His team leader, Corporal Kyle, manned the M240L machine gun. As his assistant gunner, it was Tom's responsibility to carry spare linked ammunition belts, call out fire adjustments, and act as a bodyguard to the corporal and his weapon, should the enemy attempt to flank them. After leaving the chopper, Tom and Kyle moved forward to their designated blocking position, a vantage point in which a fire team can set up and intercept enemy forces attempting to enter or leave the targeted area. The target in this case was a small village, seemingly abandoned and heavily deteriorated, with crumbling masonry and multiple bombed-out huts. The entire place was incredibly unsettling, showing no signs of life other than a single black cat that slinked amongst the shadows of the buildings. The moon was high in the sky at night, bathing the ramshackle collection of seemingly ancient structures in an eerie light. After ensuring the M2 was set up, Tom surveyed the village, focusing on a damaged stone wall less than 50 meters away. There was a hole punched out in the center of it, just large enough for a man to stick his head and shoulders through. He watched the hole intently for almost the entirety of the mission, infrared laser lined up, and M4A1 at the ready, expecting the barrel of an AK-47 to appear at any moment. But it never did. The rifle teams proceeded into the village and searched it from top to bottom, finding no trace of the HVT they were after, or any signs of life at all for that matter. Kyle and Tom relocated to link up with several members of a rifle squad in a large ditch over 100 meters away from the target site. They continued to watch the perimeter as discussions were being held on how to proceed. That's when all hell broke loose. One of the platoon's senior sergeants came running over, yelling at Tom and the other Rangers to get the fuck out of the ditch. The comms net exploded with orders to fall back to the LZ for immediate exfiltration. Tom and Kyle were beyond confused. Had EOD picked up on something? Maybe they were all standing on top of a buried IED belt, something far from unheard of. The Canucks double-timed it back to their location and landed, allowing all the Rangers to board. After a final headcount to ensure no one had been left behind, the helicopters lifted off and returned to the airfield. The mission had lasted less than an hour, seemingly ending as soon as it began, all without a single shot being fired and no contact with the Taliban. Or so Tom thought. After returning to base, the platoon was debriefed, and the reason for the sudden scrub of the mission became very clear. Shortly after Tom and Kyle had posted up in the ditch, signal collection specialists attached to the Rangers had picked up on enemy radio chatter in the vicinity of the assault force. Very clearly and calmly, the Taliban had spoken.
"There are 6 men in the ditch. 2 of them are manning the machine gun on the leftmost edge. They are facing the northwest. You can flank them if you follow the brim."
They proceeded to list a multitude of details about the assault force and their positions. They were stalking the Rangers, hunting the hunters. Based on the chatter, it was clear that an unknown number of insurgents were setting up for a potentially deadly ambush. Other than the intercepted broadcast, the Rangers had been completely unaware of their presence. None of the men on the ground had seen any indication of enemy activity. The trained canines hadn't picked up on any scent. The drones and overwatch aircraft circling the area didn't see a damn thing, even with thermal vision. Yet the Taliban were listing numerous, meticulous details about the Rangers, as if they were standing next to them in the darkness. It was a humbling experience for the entire platoon. For Tom, that mission always sent a shiver up his spine, looking back on it. Even though later ops during the same deployment involved full-scale firefights and ambushes. This story takes place 2 years ago, when I was still in primary school. I was 12 at the time. There was this organization for young girls who needed help building their self-confidence and basically have fun while they still could. Because once we got to high school, the activities wouldn't be arranged anymore. One day there wasn't many girls, so the leaders, we'll call them Lisa and Beth, decided just to bring the class to the playground next to the school, where we went twice a week. It was around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. At the opposite end of the playground is a row of houses. There was a woman, maybe in her late 30s, and a boy, about 7 years old, in the corner. They both had dark hair and looked to be of Asian descent. I don't remember what they were doing exactly, but I just got a very uneasy feeling. I didn't really like the woman and didn't want to get very close to her. She just seemed so odd in her mannerisms and gave me the creeps. But luckily they stayed in the corner and I stayed close to Lisa and Beth, so I figured it would all be okay. We played for about 15 minutes before we took a short break. I was just randomly looking in the direction of the fence when I noticed a boy at the end of the playground behind the fence. He was about 25 feet from the mother and the other boy. He looked about the same age and had blonde hair. I thought this was odd, as this young child was there all alone. I suddenly noticed the mother walking towards one of the houses on the opposite side of the playground, and I spotted the two boys approaching each other. I turned around to tell Lisa about them when suddenly my friend Jody ran past me, crying hysterically. Lisa began to panic at Jody's behavior and asked what was wrong. Before they could get a straight answer out of her, I heard a scuffle and noticed the two boys were now locked in a physical altercation. Then I noticed the woman returning from the house, and my blood went ice cold. She was holding a large knife in her hand and was heading directly towards the boys. All the girls in my group ran out of the playground. 2 of them were crying, and I stood paralyzed and shaking, convinced I was going to witness a woman stabbing what appeared to be a 7-year-old boy to death. Beth began moving quickly towards the woman to intercept her, and Lisa went to break up the fighting boys. When Beth asked the woman why she had the knife, she just laughed sarcastically and said something about cutting down some branches to make a treehouse. That made no sense at all because it was in the middle of autumn, so there were branches all over the ground. Lisa called the police, and we were all told to move further away for safety. 10 minutes later, we noticed red and blue lights coming from the distance. I tried confronting Jody, who was still crying, but I was having trouble keeping a brave face myself. After being confronted by Beth, the strange woman had gone back in the house to put the knife away. I guess she got the sense the police were on their way. After the police arrived, she was interviewed, but wasn't taken into custody, probably because there wasn't enough evidence to arrest her. The mother of the second boy eventually arrived and held him tight. I don't know why she left him alone there. I assume he just walked away from her and she lost him. So that's my story. I still don't know what she was planning on doing with that boy who was fighting her son, but with such a large knife, her intentions could not have been good. When me and my best friend were younger, we would ask our babysitter to take us to the school playground at night so we could play hide and seek. We lived in a small town where everyone knew everyone, and we were friendly with one another. So this wasn't abnormal or dangerous, at least, not at the time. One night we went over past our bedtimes, but our parents were cool and let us stay up to play hide and seek. At one point, I was trying to find my friend and my babysitter. As I looked for them, a car slowly drove by the playground. Their lights were off and the windows were tinted. I watched them as they drove by and felt as though they were watching me. When they were out of sight, I instantly forgot about it and went back to seeking. It came to be around midnight, and our babysitter thought that it was about time to go. Of course, we begged to stay a little longer, but he said it was late. We started to walk up the hill that was behind the school. We then all heard a car behind us, and we look over to see the same car driving on the grass towards us. My babysitter instantly grabbed both of us and threw us over his shoulders and started running towards the bushes that cut us off from the other street. The car started to speed up, and so did my babysitter. When we got to the bushes, my babysitter forced us through and up a metal fence behind them. I ended up getting cuts everywhere, but worst of all, I cut my leg on the fence and was bleeding badly. I could hear the driver of the car calling out to us, asking in a kind voice, "Where are you?" Then, in a serious and scary voice,
"I know you're in there. I'm gonna find you."
We ended up getting to a house that had lights on, and our babysitter banged on the door, begging to let us inside, and that he had kids and one of them was bleeding. A woman who we knew as Emily opened the door and pretty much dragged us inside and shut the door behind her. Later that night, the police were called, and I was sent to the hospital to get stitches and a shot for the rusty metal I had cut my leg on. It doesn't end there, though. Later that week, my dad was watching the news as usual, and a story came up. It showed the playground that we were at a couple of nights ago, and showed two medics rolling a body covered with a white sheet into an ambulance. The girl had been dead for a couple of days, and her body hadn't even been there for very long. The killer was never found, so he could still be out there. Sometimes I wonder if the man in the car did get us. Would we have been in the same situation that girl ended up in, and she would have been watching the news to see our bodies being rolled into an ambulance? It makes me feel guilty, but I will never, and have never, stepped another foot in that playground since. When this happened, I was about 12 or 13. I was staying the night at my friend Rose's house, and her mom left us to care for her little sister while she went out for a few hours. Being the good babysitters we were, we decided to head over to a local park that had a playground, just to hang out for a while and let her sister play. We had been there for about 30 minutes, and we were just hanging out and pushing her little sis on the swings when two guys showed up and sat at a picnic table close to the playground. The first guy looked to be in his teens, probably 5'10", short dark hair, brown eyes, and medium build. But the other guy had to have been in his early 30s. He was very large, probably at about 6'1", 250 pounds, and had a full beard and shoulder-length curly hair with green eyes. We noticed when they sat down, but didn't really give them a second thought. Apart from their age and physical appearance, there was nothing that really stood out about them, until the older guy, whose name was Chris, decided to start a conversation with us. At first, he asked us our names and gave us theirs, and then asked what we were up to today. Still being the polite kid I was raised to be, I answered him, but I kept my answer short and continued to play with Rosa and her sister. He kept asking questions like where we were heading later, and rather we wanted to hang out with him and his nephew, who was the younger guy, whose name I can't remember, all the while getting closer and closer to us as he was talking. We told him that we were just going home after Rosa's sister was done playing, and that we weren't allowed to go anywhere else. He then offered me some beer that he had with him and asked me if I smoked. I had never drank any alcohol at that point, and I wasn't about to start then, so I declined his offer. He then told me how pretty I was and asked me if I had a boyfriend, and without skipping a beat, told me that he had recently just gotten out of jail and was looking for a girlfriend. I told him that I didn't have a boyfriend and I wasn't interested in having one either. During this whole interaction, he would occasionally address his attention to his nephew, and from the interactions that they had, I quickly caught on that they were in a gang, which is when I actually started getting nervous, as even I knew that you didn't mess with the people in the local gangs. I knew that we had to be careful about what we said next. He was quiet after that, and I figured that they were going to move on and bug someone else, but I was wrong. He then asked me again what we were going to do later, and if we wanted to hang out with them instead, telling us how much fun we would have, and how they could buy us beer, or whatever we wanted. I told him again we couldn't go anywhere, and we had to watch Rosa's little sister. Then he went quiet again. I know we should have just picked up and left right then, but I had just started getting into my rebellious stage and thought we could handle these guys, no problem. And they weren't really a threat. We weren't ready to go back to Rosa's house just yet, and we went and sat on another picnic table, thinking that if we ignored them, they would get the hint and go away. Of course, not 1 minute later, Chris and his nephew came and sat with us. His nephew stayed at one end of the table, but Chris decided to come sit right next to me and started telling me again about how pretty I was and how he could be my boyfriend and we should just go and hang out at his place or wherever I wanted to go. At this point, his nephew started looking kind of nervous. He was very casually chatting with Rosa, but I could tell he realized how young we were and that his uncle was really starting to cross the line. He told him he thought they should go do something else because Rosa and I couldn't go anywhere, but Chris wasn't having any of that. I don't remember what he said next, as he was still sitting next to me, but the next thing I know, he puts his arms around my shoulders and pulled me into his side. I was completely caught off guard and didn't even know how to react. I had never had an older guy that close to me, let alone touch me like that. I know I should have at least pushed him away or done something, but I just froze. He kept saying again and again how he could be my boyfriend, and he would take good care of me, asking me if I could go somewhere with him. But I told him no, and started trying to slowly get out from under his arm without making a big deal out of it. At that moment, I started getting scared, as he was getting really pushy, and I didn't want to piss him off, as it was just us in the park, and I couldn't see or hear anyone else around. He then pulls me closer to him, and this time he kissed me. It wasn't just a quick little peck, it was a forceful, lingering kiss that completely threw me off. My mind started racing. I couldn't believe what just happened, and even Rosa was just sitting there with a look of complete shock on her face. I decided that I had enough of this, and we had to get out of there. I pulled away one last time, and he told me again we should go somewhere to have some fun. He wasn't very creative, and just kept saying the same things over and over again, just wording them slightly different. It was now very obvious what he had on his mind. I told him that it was getting late, and we had to get Rose's little sister home, as her mom was going to be back soon. He didn't seem very happy with hearing that, so I told him that we had to take her sister home, but maybe we could come back and hang out with them some more. It was obvious he didn't want to let me go, but I promised that we would come back. Finally, I guess he either believed me or just decided to let me up, so I could go get Rose's little sister to carry her home. I had just turned around and was getting ready to tell Rosa that we had to leave now. And suddenly he changed his mind and stood up and came over to me. I had just put Rosa's little sister down for a moment as she was getting kind of heavy for me, and I knew that we had a ways to walk, so I wanted to give my arms a break for just a second. He took that opportunity to grab me from behind and pull me into him, kind of like a bear hug with his whole body pressed up against mine. A whole flood of emotions ran through me at that moment. Fear, confusion, and still a bit of denial that he would really do something to hurt me. But I knew it was wrong either way, and I needed to get the hell away from him. I was still kind of in a state of shock at the time, but I knew I had to keep my wits about me. I decided to play along and try to work out a way for him to let us leave without making him mad or think I was lying to him. I told him again that we had to go and that Rosa's mom would get mad and come looking for us, but I promised him that we would just drop her sister off and come back. He let me go, but still didn't seem convinced. I told him again as convincingly as I could that we had to take Rosa's sister home and told him just to wait for us there. He seemed to have bought it, so we quickly started walking back to Rosa's house while he and his nephew were sat at the table. As we started walking, I glanced back and saw his nephew trying to get him to leave again. So I thought, great, they're leaving, so there's no way they're going to see where we're going or follow us. Wrong. Just as I thought they were leaving in the opposite direction, Chris decided to follow us. We had a bit of a head start, but he was a really big guy and was gaining on us quickly. We hurried as fast as we could because we didn't want him to see where she lived. So once we got on her street, we took off running. We finally got back to Rosa's apartment and thought we were in the clear. I could hear Chris calling out my name, but I couldn't see him. So we all went inside as quickly and as quietly as we could. Once inside, we all went over to the window. I could still hear Chris calling out my name and getting really close, so we decided to stay quiet and carefully watch from the window to see if they had seen where we went. Luckily, they kept walking past Rosa's apartment. We both breathed a huge sigh of relief and then started freaking out because neither of us had ever experienced anything like that before, but we were so glad it was over and we were in the clear. Shortly after that, Rosa's mom got home, and we went out to meet her in the parking area. Neither of us had any intentions of telling her what happened, as Rose's mom wasn't the nicest, and we were sure we would have gotten into trouble even though we didn't do anything wrong. We all get back upstairs and were just chatting with Rose's mom and her younger brother. Then, we heard a knock at the door. My heart stopped as I could swear I heard Chris's voice on the other side of the door. We both went back into the kitchen as Rose's mom went to answer the door. It was Chris and his nephew again. Somehow they must have seen us when we went out to meet her mom in the parking lot and saw which apartment we went into. They asked Rose's mom if we were there, but luckily we were smart enough to give them fake names. And even then, Rose's mom was having none of that and told them to get the hell out of there and slam the door in their face. Of course, Rose's mom knew something was up and asked us if we knew them, but we weren't about to admit that, and we just told her that we had no idea what was going on or who they were. I don't think she really bought it, but she left it at that and told us not to answer the door. Later that evening, her mom was going out again, so it was just Rosa and I in the apartment. We were just hanging out in the living room, talking about how crazy that afternoon turned out to be and how glad we were that we didn't get into any trouble. And then we heard it, two voices that sounded very familiar, just outside the window. I was terrified to even move. And then came a knock at the door. There was no way that we were going to answer it. so we just kept as quiet as possible and prayed they would just go away. They called out our names and tried knocking again. Then one of them tried turning the doorknob. Thankfully, Rose's mom had locked it on her way out. They tried knocking one more time. What we heard next was their footsteps walking away from the door. We never saw either of them again, and we didn't go back to that park again for quite some time. It was an incredibly surreal experience. However, I will never forget his face, the feel of his body against mine, or that he reeked of cigarettes and beer. This is a story I've been sitting on for a long time, mostly because it makes me realize that it's not over yet. The clock is slowly ticking until the time comes when he is free. And while I hope he's long since forgotten me, something tells me he hasn't. I should back up. This happened in 1999, when I was a sophomore in high school and 14 years old. I had just moved back to America from the Middle East, where I spent about 5 or 6 years. Because of the standard of dress there, and the fact that my old school had uniforms, and I had no social life, I didn't own a t-shirt, let alone a pair of jeans. Every day I went to school wearing a long dress or a long skirt, with my mousy blonde hair tied back, with a scarf like a headband. I was awkward, mousy, and had a hard time making friends. This was a couple of years before 9/11, but in my little town there, there was still animosity towards anyone different. And with my British accent, and the fact of where I grew up, I was pretty different. I only had 3 friends, Joe, Nathan, and Kenny. Joe lived on my bus route, though he was way out in the middle of the country, so he and his 2 younger brothers were always the first on the bus in the morning, and the last off the bus in the evening. Our day always followed the same schedule. I would get on the bus, go sit next to Joe, and we'd talk for a little bit until we got to school. Then we would hang out with Nathan and Kenny for a bit and go to our separate classes. I was in advanced placement classes, and they were in the regular ones, so I didn't share any with them. But every other day our lunches coincided, so the 4 of us would get to eat together. Then, in the evenings, Kenny and Nathan would get picked up, and Joe and I would take the bus home. I don't really remember how we started dating. I think Joe told me that he liked me, and I said that I liked him back. And then our routine would change ever so slightly, and that we would start holding hands on the bus and at lunchtime, while Kenny and Nathan teased us relentlessly. It was so innocent, even for 14. Joe was sweet and thoughtful, and completely non-threatening. He was the type to always make sure you had the better half of something. Always the first to offer his coat when you're cold, and always pulling out chairs and holding doors open. A real gentleman. This went on for weeks, though it stayed strictly at school. We weren't able to see each other outside of school because he always had to go straight home, or his mother would be furious. Sometimes he would come to school with bruises, but he always said it was from roughhousing with his brothers, and I didn't really have a reason to doubt him. Then one day, there was an upcoming half day from school. Joe suggested that he come over my place, and we could have our first afternoon together. We were both excited. He would take the bus to my stop, and then either walk or my parents would drive him home later. It was going to be great. I was beside myself with excitement. Everything went smoothly until the actual half day. One of his brothers had found out about his plan and told his mother. She then called up to the school, apparently shrieking like a banshee and demanding that he come home not a minute late or he would be in a world of hurt. He told me at my stop that he would go home, talk to her, and then be back as soon as he could, even if he had to walk. I was worried, but he kissed my cheek and said everything would be alright, and that he would be there in an hour or so. So I went inside and waited, and when I finally got tired of waiting inside, I went out with my dog and waited. I thought about calling him, but the one time I tried that before, his mother had spewed a bunch of venom at me for daring to call their house, and the idea made me cringe, so I just waited. Eventually the sun went down, and he never showed up, and never called. I was disappointed, but I decided it was probably for the best, and went about my evening as usual. The next morning, when I got on the bus for school, the bus driver looked at me and suddenly started sobbing. I thought that was odd, but it was kind of a dreary day in general, so maybe I was reading too much into it. I started heading for the back of the school bus and noticed that Joe wasn't there. Neither were his two brothers. That was odd. I was starting to get worried, but I thought that maybe their mother had taken them to school herself that day. The bus route went along as normal for a while, until we came to a heavily forested area, where the driver pulled over. She was shaking and crying, and just not acting like herself. Almost immediately, I looked out the window and see three policemen walking up to the bus. Apparently they had pulled up behind her. She talks to them for a moment, and then one of them leads her off. The other takes the wheel, and the third comes and sits by me. Neat. I get to sit next to an officer, I thought. And then I thought that I was in trouble, especially since there were so many other open seats. But he was very nice, and we chatted about school and life until we got to the campus. Then both of the remaining officers followed us inside and went into the office. I went to meet up with the boys where I usually did, but Joe wasn't there either. Neither of them had seen him. We just hoped that he was okay and went about our morning. In first period, I received a page to come to the office immediately. I thought it was about some scholarships I had been working on, but I thought it was weird they pulled me out of class. When I got there, the principal, the counselor, and the police were all there. I suddenly felt like a caged rabbit. And then, they told me what happened. The night before, when Joe got home, he had told his mother that he was coming to see me, and that was final. Obviously, they argued about it. She grounded him, and it came to blows. I found out later that his mother had been very abusive to Joe, which doesn't excuse what happened. But it does add some understanding, at least to me. After the confrontation was over, he laid in bed all night planning on what he would do. He decided that he was going to wait for his brothers to go to the school bus and hang back, telling them that he would drive himself to school, which wasn't too far out of the ordinary. Once they were gone, he would take a butcher knife from the kitchen and finish his argument with his mother, once and for all. The next morning, everything went as planned for the most part. He got his brothers up and dressed and out for school, and watched until they were at the end of the long driveway to wait for the bus. Then, while his mother was sleeping, he went into her room and stabbed her multiple times. Meanwhile, on the other side of town, the gloomy weather was causing troubles with the bus. I don't know the details, but I know that it was a few minutes late starting its route. One thing I realized while writing this, and that Hollywood seems to miss half of the time, is that when you stab someone while they're sleeping, they tend to wake up, and she did. She screamed and tried to fight back, but he was too determined and too strong. Since the bus was running late, the brothers were still standing on the side of the road, waiting, when they heard the screaming. They both turned and ran back to try to help. They tried to defend their mother, but Joe turned on them, slicing one of them across the palms and the other in the gut. Then he ran. When the bus arrived, she saw one of the brothers staggering up the driveway, covered in blood. In her panic, she kept going and called the police. Eventually, he made it to the corner store, a little ways away. Some stories say he crawled there, but I can't really confirm that, nor do I really want to. After the police finished questioning me, I was sent home. I remember lying on my parents' bed, staring at the TV while live coverage of his capture played. Or maybe it was a repeat. I don't remember. But I do remember seeing the news chopper filming as the police helicopter followed after Joe as he ran across the field. There was a cop perched out the door and braced on one of the landing struts. As the chopper got lower, he jumped out and tackled him. That was the last time I ever saw Joe. The part that creeps me out though was what happened afterwards. He pled guilty and was sentenced to 40 years for the murder and 20 for the assault on his brother. Not long after, the letter started. I never kept any, but they were long, crazy ramblings about how we would be together forever. how he did it for me, and how he truly loved me, and he would do anything to be with me. No regret, no remorse. He was happy about what he did, if it meant I was his. We moved a while later, and the letter stopped. I'm happily married now, and getting on with my life. But every time I think about him, I remember he's up for parole in 2020. What happens when he gets out? What happens if he comes looking for me? This story is told from the point of view of a female. This happened a few years ago during my first year of university. I'm from the UK, and I studied in York, which is generally considered a pretty safe city. I was with my friends on a night out clubbing, and as often happens on nights out, I lost them. I was tipsy, but by no means drunk, and at this point my friends weren't answering their phones, and I had had enough, so I decided to walk home. My house is only around a 20-minute walk from town, and we always walked home, so I didn't think much of walking home by myself. When I start walking, this guy starts walking next to me. He was Asian, maybe around 24, so not too much older than me. I was 19 at the time. York is a pretty friendly city, and tipsy students talking to other tipsy students they don't know is just the norm, so I assumed he was just like me. Just another alcohol-infused person making his way home. He started chatting to me about the usual crap, asking me what I studied and things like that. We'd only been walking for a couple of minutes when he started asking me if I had a boyfriend. At this point, I started feeling uncomfortable. We weren't in a secluded area, but it was around 3 in the morning, and there were no cars or other people around. My mind didn't instantly label him as some crazed serial killer, but a boy just trying his luck, which again, is pretty common when you're a student. It wasn't really a big deal, but I didn't want to walk with him anymore. We'd only been walking together for around 5 minutes at this point. So I tell him it was nice meeting him, and that I was at my house. I step outside some random house and stood there, waiting for him to walk away, but I think he knew I was lying, and he didn't leave. This is when I started to feel really unnerved. He smiled at me and said,
"My car is near here. Do you want a lift so I can make sure you get home safely?"
When he said this, I became terrified. My chest was so tight, I couldn't even speak. I just sort of shook my head and mumbled some incomprehensible answer. Next, he comes right over to me and grabs my arm, saying that he just wants to help me get home. I remember feeling numb, and like I wasn't a part of my own body anymore. It felt as though I was watching it happen to somebody else, and not me. I always thought that I would fight back if something like this ever happened to me, but instead, I was frozen in fear. I don't remember where the car was, or how long it took us to get there. I just remember feeling kind of floppy, and letting myself get tugged along. The next thing I remember was him opening the passenger door, and me getting in. I think he asked me where I live, but I couldn't answer at this point. He started telling me what a pretty girl I was, and how he just wanted a nice girl to talk to at home. I sat completely still and staring ahead. He then put his hand on my thigh and started stroking it, and then began touching my breast while continuing to drive one-handed. I felt disgusting and guilty, but at the same time I thought I deserved it for getting in the car in the first place, so I just let it happen. I remember thinking I should fight him off or try to get out of the car, but I honestly couldn't even speak, let alone summon the energy to struggle. I had no idea where he was taking me, but I knew that we were heading away from the university area. After around 10 minutes, I seemed to unfreeze, and it really hit me what was happening. I genuinely thought I was going to die in that car. I asked him if I could get out, but he just kept smiling at me. I'm only 5'1", and built pretty small. I didn't really stand a chance of overpowering him, and honestly, I was still too scared to try anything. At this point, my cell phone started ringing. I'd forgotten I even had a phone. I've never answered anything so fast in my life. It was one of my housemates who I was on the night out with, asking me where I was. I didn't even look to see if the guy was responding, but the next thing I know, he's pulling over and telling me to get out of the car. I had no idea where I was, so I walked around looking for a street name and rang a taxi. I was sobbing and told the taxi driver what happened, and he told me to tell the police and even offered to take me there, but I couldn't bring myself to do it, and I didn't want to stay in that car any longer than I had to. I got dropped off at home and promised that I would inform the police in the morning. I never told anyone else about what happened that night, and I blame myself for being stupid enough to walk home and for not being strong enough to fight. I pretty much willingly got in his stupid car and let myself get assaulted. I could have been raped or murdered. This whole incident has made me very distrustful of men. I have depression, anxiety, and issues with self-harm, which were triggered by what happened. This story is from the point of view of a female. A few years ago, I held two jobs, one at a taco place, the other at a small general store. The taco place was always busy. We were separated from the customers by a counter, which was about elbow height. Interactions with customers was pretty much kept to a minimum, so we could be fast and focused on making food and moving on to the next customer. Working at the general store was a lot different. It was much slower paced, except around noon, when every old person in town wanted to shop, it seemed. I usually worked nights at the general store, and days at the taco place. The work at the general store consisted of cleaning and unpacking boxes to stock the shelves, and the majority of my chores didn't involve me being behind the counter. This led to a lot more interaction with the customers in a more friendly environment. It was here that I had the encounter with the crazy man. He was a bald white guy somewhere in his 30s or 40s. Since I didn't have a car, I was getting rides to my college on the other side of town by my boyfriend, who is now my husband. The first time I saw this creep, he was walking along the sidewalk, blindfolded. It was a busy road with lots of traffic, and he had on a fucking blindfold. I guess he thought he was cool or something by showing off his ability not to stumble and die, but he just looked like a crazy person. When my boyfriend couldn't drive me, I had to walk. It was only a couple blocks from my apartment, so it wasn't too bad. The only time I had to walk in the dark was at the end of a closing shift, so I was never too worried. One day I was working at the taco place, and the blindfold man tries to talk to me. I brush him off and get back to work, helping the next customer, only giving him a brief comment and then dismissing him. Apparently this made him mad, because he stuck around, hoping that work would slow down, but it didn't. I didn't see him again until a few days later. He came into the general store, wearing the blindfold again. He took it off to shop, and then came up to the register to pay. He didn't say anything, he just stared at me as I rang up his items and told him the total. He handed me a wad of sweaty, crumpled bills that he pulled out of his pocket. I gingerly put them in the register and gave him his change. I handed him his bags, and he stared at me some more, and then left. I washed my hands and then continued on with my day. I had forgotten all about him until a week later. He shows up at my job at the taco place with a yellow plastic bag from the general store. He had obviously gone there first, and then came to the taco place looking for me. For once we were slow at the taco place, he called me over to the counter. "I know your mom," he said. I honestly didn't doubt that. My mom was into some heavy shit back then, and this guy seemed to be a tweaker. Suddenly he pulls out an envelope full of $20 bills and throws it on the counter smiling. He backs away towards the door, not saying anything else. "What's this for?" He shrugs and says, "I want to help you guys out." I take the money and look at it. I then test it with the pens we have by the registers. It was all real. He had actually given me a wad of cash that came out to be $500. Don't get me wrong, I was grateful, but I was also sketched the fuck out. After my shift, I walked over to the police department, which also was in the same lot as my other two jobs. I rang the intercom and they eventually sent out two police officers. I explained the situation. They didn't really take me seriously, They thought I was being some paranoid girl trying to friend zone some nice guy. They told me that there wasn't anything he had done wrong, and that money was mine. I had been willing to give up the money as evidence in case it was stolen or obtained due to selling heavy drugs. The guy did claim he knew my mom. That, of course, turned out to be a lie. The cops left, and nothing more came of it. I had put the incident behind me until I saw him again. It was at the store, and I was ringing him up. This time, instead of staring and saying nothing, he asked me for my phone number. Now, guys, never hit on a girl who works in customer service. She is obligated to be polite to you, but that doesn't mean she likes you just because she's being nice. Plus, it's an extremely uncomfortable situation to be in. Anyway, I came up with the first excuse I could. I don't have a phone. He didn't even blink. He just went from standing there to suddenly leaning over the register and growling in my face. What's the matter? You don't like me? You think you're too good for me? I gave you all that money. What's wrong with you? I took several steps back. What the actual fuck? Then I heard my boss call my name from across the store, asking me if I could help her adjust some shelves. The guy then walked off and left the store. I took a moment to call my boyfriend and have him come pick me up. At the end of my shift, I realized that was good thinking on my part, because the guy was standing outside the store smoking a cigarette and waiting for me. After that, I have my boyfriend pick me up and drop me off every day until I finally get a vehicle to drive to work. Later on, everyone at the taco place was talking about a stabbing that happened last night. They told me that the guy waited under someone's car while wearing a blindfold. Once they were about to open their door, this fucker stabs him in the ankle and slides out from under the car. I guess he didn't realize that there were other people in the same parking lot, because as soon as he saw them, he took off running. A few days later, I went into my second job, and my supervisor, who had been with me the night the creep was waiting for me, showed me a picture in the newspaper and an article. A few towns over, this guy had stabbed someone else, but he had actually killed them this time. He stabbed a woman 32 times before he was arrested on site. He hadn't seen anyone around this time with his blindfold. My guess is that there was enough light that he could make out the outlines of people the first time, but the second time, he chose a darker, more secluded location. So lucky for me, I didn't become a victim of this creep, but it's just scary to think that someone this crazy actually lived in the same town as me. It's really something else when you wonder about how many killers or would-be killers you might come across. Hunting is an avid hobby of mine, and it runs in my family. My favorite animals to hunt are deer and boars, as they are quite a challenge, and I love a challenge. I also love hunting in general and camping in the woods. It's therapeutic for me, as you're in nature's natural habitat, which can be greatly appreciated when you're by yourself. Accompanying this are the type of people you meet while hiking. I've met people who have shared their food and campfire with me, but most of the time it's your animal friends who accompany you. I wish the story was all about that, but things took a turn for the worst. I had recently completed an assignment which I would describe as long-winded and quite boring, even though it was my favorite topic, human biology. Due to this, I decided to take a 5-day hike across a vast stretch of woods that were brilliant for hunting. As a hunting enthusiast, I decided to hunt for some deer and possibly some boars if I came across any. So I prepped my water filter, packed my tranquilizer and hunting equipment, as well as my pop-up tent and some snacks. I took the 3.5-hour drive to my destination. I was stoked, as I could unwind around nature and enjoy the atmosphere the woods provided. I arrived at what looked like an abandoned parking lot around 3:30 p.m. All of the bays were empty, and the ranger's office looked as if it had been unoccupied for years. I brushed it off, parked, and began my hike. The place gave me a very uneasy vibe, as if the woods beyond the ranger station were kind of sinister. I can't really describe what gave me this uneasiness, but I honestly just chalked it up to the place being abandoned and creepy. Either way, I headed out onto the path and began scouting the area for animals. These woods were quite exquisite. The sun was shining through the trees, and the animals were up and active. I came across a few deer, but no boars, unfortunately. Fast forward to 8:30 p.m. It was uneventful, and it was getting pretty dark. Now, I need to add that I'm quite a paranoid guy, as I was robbed at the age of 15, and even though all was okay in the end, that paranoia of something or someone lurking in the shadows stayed with me in the back of my mind, and especially makes itself known when I'm out alone at night. Anyway, I whipped up a fire, cooked up some marshmallows, and warmed up some beans, minding my own business. After this, I decided to go on a late night hunt, as I did a 2-week course on how to hunt prey in the woods when it's dark, and I think it really paid off. 15 minutes later, I put the fire out as I prepared to leave, but then my blood ran as cold as ice, and my hands started to shake when I saw the silhouette of a person about 100 meters away from me. It was unexpected, so I internally freaked the fuck out. As well as this, I noticed a knife in their left hand, and it looked like they were crouching and stalking something, as they had their knife at the ready. I believe it was a man about 6 foot tall, and his back was facing me, so I believed that he didn't notice I was there. After shitting bricks while watching this man for about 5 minutes, he disappeared into the inky night. I got over it pretty quickly. I figured it was just another hunter like myself. I honestly wished that was the case. Fast forward about an hour. It's around 9:45 p.m. and I'm feeling confident enough to go back out and into the black wilderness and catch a deer or two, or maybe even a boar. I pinpointed where my tent was on the map and went on my way with my hunting equipment. 10 minutes later, I'm practically in no man's land. Everywhere around me was pitch black, but I knew what I was doing. I was stalking a deer, which had noticed me and was about 50 meters in front of me, just wandering around. I grabbed my tranquilizer and placed the deer in my sights. That's when I heard a twig snap. My eyes darted. My legs turned into jelly, and I jerked my neck towards the source of the noise. There was a fucking silhouette that appeared out of a tree to the left of me, about 50 yards away, and just watched me. Not the deer, but me. His size told me that he was the same guy from before. 6 foot, roughly 200 pounds. He stared at me, and I stared back. My body was still as a stone, but a sudden outburst of adrenaline was causing me to shake. I couldn't see his face, as it was too dark. Fuck, was he some kind of late-night human butcher? Will I ever see daylight again? I just about choked out. Who's there? I tried to say in the calmest voice I could, but the fear was obvious in my voice. The man raised his hand with the knife and pointed his index finger at me. That was it. I fucking bolted it, almost tripping myself up and hitting my head on some tree branches. Twigs snapped rapidly behind me. The son of a bitch was chasing me. I looked back once and saw his right hand brushing tree branches to the side of him, his knife gripped tightly in his left hand. I then realized that I dropped my tranquilizer. Fuck it, I can buy another one. I know I should have just shot the guy, but it's amazing what one can forget in a horrifying situation. Even if it's a gun, I wasn't going back for it. A ton of thoughts were going through my head while I was fleeing. Why me? What does he want? Money? Food? That was when I honestly thought I pissed myself, as he said in a rapid tone,
"Isn't this fun?"
He then had the audacity to start laughing in a patronizing way, and I couldn't take it anymore. I sped up, and let me tell you, it's amazing what the human body can do when adrenaline and instinct takes over. I've never ran so fast in my life. I made a hard right, dived into some nearby bushes, and eventually lost the guy. I heard his footsteps go in the opposite way, and it turns out that I went in a huge fucking circle, as I could see my tent, about 50 meters away. I was fucking shaking, and tears were starting to form, but I stayed strong. I tuned in my ears to the inky blackness, and I heard nothing. I saw nothing. I was not going to turn on my phone light, as it would make me a visible target. I carefully made for my tent and checked my watch. It was now 10:30 p.m. I sat still in my tent, listening to every small noise I could from the woods. I held my breath as I heard a twig snap behind me, and with that, it was accompanied by a low, sinister voice.
"You think you could run? I win."
With that, my tent was sliced open, and the fucker popped his head in. He was fucking licking his lips, and his eyes were wide open and locked with mine.
"You lose,"
he screamed as he pulled out his knife. Fighting was not my strong point, but going to the gym made me a pretty able guy. So as he tried to stab me, I grabbed both of his arms and fended off him plunging the blade into my torso. I tried to disarm the fucker, and he laughed during the process. I thought he was trying to intimidate me. However, I was ready to kill him to defend myself. I restrained his left wrist, but his knife was inches away from going into my foot, so I stepped onto his right hand and pulled back on his left wrist. Then, snap, his left wrist was broke. He let out a blood-chilling scream. I now had the upper hand, and I took advantage of it. I got the knife from his shattered hand and gave him a taste of his own medicine. I sunk the knife deep into his right hand, and he screamed. I landed a few punches, and I think I broke his nose. I grabbed my arm in pain as he fought back and bent it in an awkward position, but I honestly couldn't afford to care about my injuries. He tried to kick me, but I punched him in the face until he was unconscious. I then checked my phone. No service. I picked up the fucker into a fireman's lift, and I remembered my way to the ranger's office, as it was exactly west from my tent. After an hour of struggling with a potential killer on my shoulders, I found the ranger station, and to my surprise, a young man, around 20 years old, was there. I collapsed onto my knees, and I explained the situation. And as it turns out, the guy had slashed my left bicep, but the adrenaline numbed me to the pain. The ranger called for backup. I don't know how long it took. I left my belongings. I was not going back up there to retrieve them. The ranger offered to drive me to the nearest hospital in my car, and I did. I took him up on his offer. The night stalker was taken away, semi-unconscious. The next day, I woke up on a hospital bed to an officer sitting next to it, and what he said next was burned into my memory, never to be erased. When I first saw the killer, his back was towards me, knife in his left hand, and was crouching, as I mentioned earlier. It turns out he was stalking another hiker, who he brutally murdered and mutilated. They found chloroform at the scene, hence me not hearing any screams or cries for help. I vowed from then onwards to never go hunting by myself again. The next time I went hunting was 6 months after this incident, with four other friends. Although the woods can have a beautiful atmosphere, never judge a book by its cover, as the tables can turn within the blink of an eye. For all of you going camping and hunting, stay safe. And remember, don't think these things can't happen to you. This did not happen to me, but to my boyfriend a few years back, and I decided to share his experience. We used to live in a small farm town, where the largest store to visit was Walmart. So often we would want to buy clothes and other things like that. We had to drive an hour to a larger city, where there were malls and other options. One day my boyfriend, we'll call him Carl, and his friend Edgar, and Edgar's little brother Fabio decided to head out to the city and go to the mall to buy some clothes. They decided to head out around 6 and jumped in Edgar's car and began the drive. Not even 30 minutes into the drive, the car starts to make a weird noise and started to smoke, so Edgar pulled the car over to see what was going on. Now keep in mind that this road is completely isolated. and only has one gas station near the entrance of our town. But other than that, it's just empty countryside. After checking the car, they decided there was nothing they could do about it, and would have to call for help. Now at the time, none of these guys had phones, so that meant hiking back up the road to the gas station, which would take about an hour or more to get to. Edgar tells his little brother just to stay behind and wait in the car, while they went to the gas station. His brother was only 12 years old, so probably not the smartest idea for him, but I guess in their minds it was okay. Anyways, Carl and Edgar began the hike up the road, and decided that if they cut across some fields, they would reach the gas station in half the time, and after quite a bit of walking, they arrived at the gas station, and used the phone to call Edgar's dad. Of course, his dad was angry that the car was in bad shape, but was even more pissed that Edgar had left his little brother all alone. He told him and Carl to head back to the car, and he would drive down the road and meet them there after work. So they hung up, thanked the guy at the counter, and head out on the long walk back to the car. By this point, it was dark, and when they arrived, they were exhausted and just ready to go home. They walked up to the car to get in, and then noticed that Fabio was gone, and the front window had been smashed open, and glass was everywhere. Carl and Edgar both began to freak out and yell for his brother while looking around the area to see if anyone was nearby. The two of them both began to freak out and yell for his brother while looking around the area to see if he was anywhere nearby. They decided to turn on the car so that the headlights would illuminate the street and hopefully help them look to see if they could find his little brother or what may have caused the damage. They soon heard the sound of a car coming up and turned around to see Edgar's dad pulling on the side of the road beside their car. Once he found out that Fabio was missing, he began to freak out as well. They were so busy being frantic that they didn't notice someone was walking towards them from the direction Edgar's dad had just come from. It was Fabio. He was confused and wondering why everyone was yelling, and they explained because they thought he had been kidnapped. Fabio was surprised to see the window was broken, since the car had been in perfect condition when he had headed to the gas station to get something to eat. Edgar and Carl then realized that that was why they never encountered him, since he had taken the main road. Things quieted down as the guys started to inspect the engine. It was only then that they began hearing a rustling noise. Everyone went quiet and listened. Edgar's dad yelled for whoever it was to come out. He grabbed the tire iron and handed Carl and Edgar two other random tools to hold on to as he walked towards the brush. It was then that a stranger emerged from the leaves. He was tall and skinny, and by what Carl told me, he looked to be strung out on some type of drug, with bloodshot eyes, and his movements were just off. Edgar's dad asked him what he was doing out there, to which he replied, "Out for a walk." Edgar headed over to the stranger and started yelling at him for breaking into his car. The guy became very defensive and started yelling back about how he didn't do it. At this point, Carl was still across the street with Fabio when he noticed more movement in the brush. And as he looked closer, he noticed that there was another guy and girl trying to sneak behind Edgar and his dad. It looked like the girl was carrying a large bag and the guy a long pipe. Carl cried out to Edgar and his dad, and they quickly turned around to see the two people just crouching down behind them. Carl said he wasn't quite sure what happened. Carl said he wasn't quite sure what happened next, since it happened so fast, but a fight broke out between everyone. As the scene unfolded, Carl was still beside Fabio and the car and was getting ready to join in, when everything went silent. It was then they noticed that Edgar had a gun pointed at his face from the drugged out guy who was just shaking and stammering that they would shoot them. He kept pointing the gun first at Edgar's face, then his dad, and then back again. He told them that they would let them go and not follow them, or else he would shoot the both of them in the head. He and the two others walked across the street and into the field, disappearing into the darkness. Edgar and his dad were bloody from the scuffle and told Carl and Fabio to get into his car and that they would come back tomorrow to fix the engine. Everyone piled into his car and they took off. Carl said that the car ride home was silent. Now I asked him if Edgar's dad ever called the cops, and he said to his knowledge they never did. Carl was dropped off at his house around 1 a.m. and called me right after that. I remember thinking how close he had been to never coming home. Carl thinks back to that day sometimes and thinks about how lucky he is to have survived. That year there were a lot of car break-ins, and we all wondered if it was the same group of people. I guess we'll never know.
There's always a reason to be afraid.